you've been working with the grammar of cinema and the history of cinema for many years in the gallery and in museums. But for this particular subject, this is the first time that you've actually made something meant to be shown in a cinema. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, for this material, the story of Bobby Sands and his hunger strike, what was it that you could do in the cinema that you couldn't do in a gallery or a museum?
It was narrative storytelling. The situation is this, that any and everyone knows a story from, I don't know, Ohio to Papua New Guinea, any and everyone knows a story. But not every and anyone was sort of brought up in the idea of contemporary art and what that is and how that sort of can sort of relate to them within sort of meaning as such. So with storytelling, with narrative, you can reach more people and therefore that journey, that linear, is just interested me, particularly in this sort of story as such. And the idea, in some ways, for me, the meaning of living and the meaning of dying as such. Reasons for living, the reasons for dying as such.
There's enormous restraint in your technique in the film, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about it. As you were pulling the story together, and as you were deciding what shape the film would take, what sorts of things did you not want to put into the story? Because we've seen so many biopics of different characters from recent history, particularly in Northern Ireland, and there's a certain kind of vernacular, a certain way of telling that story, which is largely absent in this film.
I don't know. What I mean by that is I do what I do. I'm not left-handed or right-handed. I do what I do. I don't think about what other people have done before, because it's not, my footprints are different from anyone else's footprints. So it's a case of looking and then seeing what I wanted and doing it. It's not about, it's about communicating ideas within images. For example, the frame ratio. The frame ratio, this wide ratio, is kind of interesting to me because it's like a modern painting. What I mean by that is that you always have to put two things in the frame. And what I mean by that, when you put two things in the frame, for example, a banana and a gun, that tells it has a narrative, one and one is two. And at the same time, you're moving the film along within the story. So within that frame, you have a multi-layer of information, not just the story, but little bits of information which you are grabbing along the way in order to sort of build a bigger picture of the film.
And you've worked often in your installation work with yourself as one of the subjects in the frame. In this case, you're working with Michael Fassbender, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about working with him as an actor and the demands that you placed on him for the role.
We should get Michael on, actually. Yeah. I'll go ahead. Michael, come on.
Short, it was a very sort of easy working relationship.
we have a few minutes for your comments and questions, so if you've got something you want to ask to either Michael or to Steve, please raise your hand. It's a little dark in the back, so please wave. Yes, right in the back, right there. Yes, you.
You're looking for some tips? Stand up and let's take a look at you. Well, you know, I mean, it's sort of, there was no way of sort of getting around it, you know, sort of to die of sort of starvation. Obviously, I had to look pretty thin. But it was 10 weeks. I had 10 weeks to lose the weight. And I ate berries, lots of berries and nuts. Sardines.
There's your tip. Anyone else? Yes, right here. Yeah.
How do you go from a film like 300, where you were so focused on building the body, and then going to this movie? How do you do that emotionally?
Question is about going from a film like 300 to Hunger.
Emotionally, I suppose. Well, you know, 300. It's like you're playing a soldier, so a Spartan soldier. So you know, their shields alone were about 30 pounds in weight. So it's basically you just have to learn how to fight and look like you know how to fight at least, and just sort of you know get in shape. That was really what was required for that, and that was a challenge for that role. Whereas this one, you know, it was much more sort of. Of a character sort of driven piece and sort of more of an internal experience really, whereas 300 is, you know, it's an extravaganza. We had 10 weeks of training before we started filming Hunger, I mean 300. So, you know, you just sort of tick the boxes, what's required for each thing, you know, and if you're playing a soldier running around in leather speedos, you want to look your best.
Great. There's a question right here. Yes? Question is about the texture of a particular scene in the film. See?
The baton on the shield is what they used to do before they pulled the prisoners out. So all I wanted to do was continue that sort of ritualistic sound on the shield. You know, and it when I heard it when we were rehearsing the first time, I thought that's good for the soundtrack. Because it was just this relentless beat, relentless sort of, and it wasn't a drum, it was a physical, it was a deliberate, and it had violence in it, the sound. It wasn't music, it was violence. And that's what I wanted to carry through in that whole gauntlet section. And as far as music is concerned, you know, in movies, I have problem with sound anyway. Problem with sound in general and music and how people say and what people do. So I just tend to sort of be very, very careful in how one layers the sort of sound in the movie. I'm particular about sound. I think that this film for me is all about taste, is all about sound and all about texture, very much, and smell. That's what I want to sort of like put on the screen as such.
Thank you. There is a question, yes, back here.
Well, my mum's from the north, so I used to go up there quite a bit when I was younger. All my cousins and everything are from there, so I have a bit of a sort of inside track there. But just repetition, really. You know, you sort of I had a dialect coach recording some stuff for me on a disc, and then you just sort of you just repeat it over and over, you know, for whatever 5-6 hours a day until it sounds right. So just really sort of boring repetition, really.
question here? Question is, has there been any backlash in the UK because of the subject matter?
Not yet, no. I expect it.
Yes? Question is about the long dialogue sequence between Bobby and the priest, and was that originally designed, or did that arrive through some other method?
It was key. I had the idea quite quickly of the conversation, because in a way, what I had in my mind's eye was a Connors McEnroe Wimbledon final in my mind. Two people on the same side, wanting the same thing but very differently. And the whole idea of that conversation in some ways is like, I was a bit irreverent of the audience. I couldn't care less about the audience at that point. The whole idea of the audience, you know, usually when you have a shot like that, it's usually a one shot at one person and a reverse shot at the other person. So therefore, in effect, that person is speaking to the audience. I didn't want that. I wanted an intimate conversation between two people. And therefore, within that intimacy, there was at the same time a distance, like, you know, a reverence of the audience. So what happens to the audience, I hope, is that the eyes become much more attuned, the ears become much more sharper to what's going on the screen. And the whole idea of having it in that length, in that linear, is real-time conversation. So like, for example, myself, if you have a conversation, it'd be quite awkward at the beginning, always, and it's become this, you tell it about yourself, you tell it about myself, and then you get hopefully somewhere. So therefore, within the sort of the structure of the film, having that sort of the large part of real time, I imagine, you know, for everyone here, it's normal. It doesn't seem like they're putting up in the scene. And therefore, you cut back in film time, and the holiday of the last scene of swooping on the piss is almost like a lull. It's almost like a sort of for you to sort of digest what happened in the previous scene, the information, a lot of information, so they just digest it and to lull you. Just to digest what actually happened in that conversation.
There's a question up here, yes.
Yeah, no, it's great when you have somebody like Liam Cunningham as well, you know, to work opposite.
We've got time for just one or two more questions right here. About the comparison between Steve's installation work, where he often uses found material, find something, and then having utter control in this film.
You always find something. You know, you always find something in a fabricated situation or in a so-called real situation. You always find something. It's just got to look carefully, look hard. You always find the extraordinary in the ordinary. Always.
Right, good. And one last question right here. Yes. Yep, you.
I wondered what was the motivation to take the role, to accept the role? Because it's kind of hard.
Why did you take the role?
Because of Steve, really. I mean, you know, it was a pretty extraordinary script when I read it. You know, it's like, it's not every day that you get something where in the first act there's hardly a word that's passed, and then you have this cascade of dialogue in the second act. So I knew it was a very challenging script and interesting. But then once, you know, once I met Steve, I was just convinced that I had to work with him and that I would learn a lot from that process.
Thank you. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I'll just ask you to join me in thanking again.